Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is part two of our discussion of a book called Always Hungry. I'm very excited to interview today's guest because he's a distinguished endocrinologist and researcher at Boston Children's Hospital. He's a professor of pediatrics at Harvard and a professor of nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health. And I've been meaning to interview him for a long time. Now we have the opportunity because he's got a book that's called Always Hungry. It's just out. And it's getting rave reviews from people who are following this program. And in part one, we laid the scientific groundwork for why this should work. Essentially, it is a program that attacks our carbohydrate cravings and breaks our dependency on a quick fix from readily available sugars. So how does that translate, Dr. Ludwig, into a tangible program? Your program is it's a three-part, three-stage program.
That's right. And our mantra is forget calories, focus on quality, and let your body do the rest. You know, as we talked about in part one, if you just cut back on calories, as conventional approaches would have us do, you know, eat less, move more, you start to lose weight. And sometimes that can come off in a dramatic way for a few months. But then the work starts. Hunger rises and metabolism slows as your body fights back. And what are you supposed to do? Spend the rest of the year, the rest of your life, battling those basic biological responses? So we try to reverse that by treating the underlying drivers of weight gain, which is too much of the hormone insulin and chronic inflammation. When you do that, as we discussed, fat cells calm down, they store fewer calories, they release those pent-up calories back into the body. Your brain says, wow, this feels good. I haven't had, you know, so much to eat in a long time. I can turn off the hunger and craving centers. I can speed up metabolism. And then weight loss occurs perhaps more slowly, but in a progressive and sustainable way. So, you know, which do you want to do? Lose 30 pounds in 2 months and then be starving? Or lose 30 pounds in a year but feel great and not suffer from hunger and feel like you can lose another 30 pounds a year later.
And learn a whole new set of food habits and food responses and sort of break that cycle of looking for the quick fix that enormous craving that belies the fact that you're carrying excess fat in your body.
That's right. We're trying to create the right internal conditions in the body to promote optimal metabolic well-being. Weight loss is a happy side effect. It's not the primary goal. It may be what brings a lot of people to the book, but the main point is to create a healthy metabolic environment where the body's inborn weight control systems that have been evolved over millions of years, can do the job and can control weight successfully just as it has throughout human history. You know, the irony is if calorie counting were so critical to weight control, how did humans ever manage to avoid massive swings in body weight before the very notion of the calorie was invented about 100 years ago?
There were no diet books, in Paleolithic times.
There were no calorie counters. There were no calorimeters that measured calories. So we put the full focus on food quality, and we tell people to forget the calories. Eat until satisfied. Snack when hungry. Let your body do the rest. So we have three phases.
Sure.
The first phase is just 2 weeks. We call it a boot camp for your fat cells, but not for you. It's a rich, satisfying high-fat diet with nuts and nut butters, full-fat dairy, rich sauces and spreads, dark chocolate, savory proteins, and slow-digesting natural carbohydrates, so it's not an Atkins-type diet. 50% fat, so it's a real jump start to the system. And we find that many people, even before they've lost the first pound, report their cravings are decreased. And we have, if we have time, we could talk about a research study that shows why the actual part of the brain that is involved in producing cravings, why that part of the brain calms down. But this is a two-week phase, and we're not looking for a lot of weight loss in those 2 weeks, although some people do lose 8 or 10 pounds, but we're just looking for people to turn off the starvation response in the body to be turned off. People will experience that as a better control over hunger, fewer cravings, better energy, a sense of enhanced sense of well-being. Then we go into phase two, where we add back whole kernel grain products, so unprocessed grains, very slow digesting. It broadens the diet a little bit. We bring down fat from 50% to 40%, so still higher than we're used to, but not quite so high as those first 2 weeks. And we stay in phase two until weight comes down to its new lower set point. When weight plateaus out at that level, we go into phase three, where we get to mindfully reintroduce some of the more processed carbohydrates to the body's ability to handle it. You know, some people will be able to, and our philosophy is minimum of deprivation for maximum of benefit. If you can handle it, you know, we're not asking you to give up all processed carbs. Enjoy some linguine when you're traveling Italy, or a slice of ice cream cake at a party at home. But for many people, they will have discovered that that sense of control over their hunger, over their body weight, sometimes for the first time in their adult life, is worth much more than the fleeting pleasures of the processed carbohydrates. And we have tools and trackers to help people figure out where their tipping point is.
Okay. And then part three?
So that was the part three. So part two is that we add back the whole kernel grains.
Right.
Non-starchy
part
vegetables.
Part three is more a maintenance phase.
Phase three is where you create your own individualized prescription by beginning to add back a little processed carbs, to play with protein, fat, and carbohydrate. So you find your own sweet spot. One size doesn't fit all. We think that the nutrients in part one and two are going to get most people there the easiest and the quickest. But then, you know, phase three is for that personalization process.
Okay, and there are certain lifestyle accoutrements to this. You talk about exercise, and you talk about sleep. Now, this is not a program that involves, like, very heavy-duty intensive exercise. Why isn't exercise the answer?
Right. Well, we do absolutely encourage and focus on and have support tools related to quality sleep, stress relief, and enjoyable physical activities. Each of these can influence fat cells directly or indirectly, synergizing with diet to help those fat cells calm down. It's in the subtitle of the book. We're going to retrain our fat cells so that they cooperate with the rest of the body. Sleep deprivation, we now can cause hormonal changes that that drive fat storage. Stress and cortisol that comes from stress, programs fat cells for calorie storage. Physical activity has benefits as well to improve insulin sensitivity, also reduce chronic inflammation. But we endorse physical activity for those benefits, not specifically to burn off a lot of calories. You know, you could spend 20 grueling minutes on a treadmill and then replace those calories in literally a few seconds with just a handful of raisins. Nature is cruel in that way. The calories go in very easily, and they come out much more slowly. So short of marathon levels, we really can't influence our calorie balance very much. And the studies show that exercise alone is not a good way to lose weight. It has important benefits to metabolism, but you have to combine it with the right diet to really maximize weight loss. And so we focus on enjoyable physical activities. If they're enjoyable, you're going to do it, and you're going to naturally benefit from it on a regular basis.
So I'm intrigued by the cravings research that you mentioned when you were describing part one. There was a little segue that you promised to share with us.
Great, yes. Well, we published a study in American Journal of Clinical Nutrition in 2013. We took 12 young adults who had high BMI, and gave them in a crossover fashion. So they received both two milkshakes on different days. One milkshake was made from highly processed, fast-digesting carbohydrate, basically corn syrup, so sugar. The other was made from a slower-digesting, less processed carbohydrate, called uncooked cornstarch. And otherwise, the milkshakes have the same protein, fat, and carbohydrate. And we even controlled the sweetness with slightly different amounts of artificial sweetener. So neither the participants nor the researcher who was running the study that day could tell the difference. So this was a double-blind study. We gave them the milkshakes. We saw after the fast-acting milkshake, as expected, the blood sugar and insulin initially surged. By 4 hours later after the meal, blood sugar crashed after the high glycemic index milkshake.
Mm-hmm. Almost like a glucose tolerance test. You know, that's a familiar,
that's right,
familiar ritual for exactly some of our patients. Yeah.
That's absolutely right. It was like a glucose tolerance test, and except with a little more protein and fat in there. And so at that moment, you know, this is the problems don't happen an hour after you eat processed carbohydrate, because that's when these calories are flooding into your body and you're feeling great. The problems happen a few hours later when all those calories have been locked away into storage sites and your brain starts to suffer from calorie deprivation. So at that time, we did brain imaging studies with something called functional MRI. Mm-hmm. And that lets us look at the activity directly happening in the brain. And we saw one area lit up like a laser. After every subject, more it lit up after the fast-digesting milkshake compared to the slow. I'd never seen in a research study before, in a nutrition study, every single participant respond the same way. So we had astronomically strong p-value statistical treatment. That area was called the nucleus accumbens.
Mm.
The nucleus accumbens,
let me guess, it's the craving center of the brain.
For those of you who, you know, aren't neuroscientists, like I'm not a neuroscientist, I didn't know what that area was until we looked at it. That's the center of the dopamine striatal pleasure and reward system. Mm-hmm. It's considered ground zero for the classic addictions like cocaine, mm-hmm, alcoholism, heroin abuse, raising a provocative question as to whether these highly processed carbohydrates are hijacking fundamental pleasure and reward systems in the brain, producing something akin to food addiction. Not because they're so tasty. Remember, both of those milkshakes tasted about mm-hmm the same, yep, had the same sweetness, and this was 4 hours later. It's not that these processed carbohydrates are so tasty, it's that they are producing metabolic effects on our body that's activating brain centers involved in craving and hunger. And that's not a calorie in, calorie out phenomenon. We have to think about foods in a much more fundamental way.
Now, that's a beautiful little experiment that illustrates the importance of the type of foods you eat as opposed to the quantities. You write, all breakfasts are not created equally. I think that that's a useful follow-up to this research where you feed refined sugar to patients and find their brains light up. What's a preferable breakfast in your program?
Well, you know, I could take you through a day on phase one. Now, remember, phase one is the most restrictive part of the program.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, here goes. A typical day. Breakfast huevos rancheros, or Mexican eggs, but instead of the tortilla, because that's a grain product we don't have in phase one, we'll have full-fat Greek yogurt and raspberries. Morning snack, herb-roasted Parmesan chickpeas. Lunch, steak salad with real blue cheese dressing, mm-hmm, although there's also vegetarian options. Afternoon snack, a little lighter, almond butter with apple slices. Dinner, coconut curry shrimp on a bed of spinach, but you're not done because you get to have dessert. In fact, we recommend dessert every day on the meal plan. Dessert is a great way to increase your fat intake. And so how about dark chocolate with strawberries dipped in real whipped cream?
Hmm.
Now, this is the most restrictive part of the program. No deprivation here.
Doesn't sound like a lot of deprivation to me. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? You've got, of course, the book, Always Hungry, available via the usual sources. There's a Facebook community. And is there a website that listeners can look to,
yes,
get more resources?
Absolutely. Well, first again, our Facebook community is the official Always Hungry book community. Put in an invite. We'll welcome you right into the community. There's no charge at all, and you can get lots of supports. Work with communicate with other people on the program. And ultimately, although we didn't focus much about this, we also want to be thinking about how to create a larger social environment such that the healthier choice is the easy, convenient, and inexpensive choice. We've actually produced the opposite, what has been called a toxic environment. I talk in the epilogue about this, the epilogue of the book, and present a 10-point plan for helping to restore healthy food as really a national priority. And, you know, in our Facebook community, we're all working to make ourselves healthier. But once we have produced healing in our own lives and in our own families, we can all join together, create grassroots campaigns. This is happening in many places around the country, and I hope that our Facebook community will be such, where we add our voice to showing how healthy food can be healing, and insisting on policies and regulations in Washington that will help facilitate that. So that's our Facebook community, and your listeners can also find me on my website, Dr. as in DR, davidludwig.com, or on Twitter and elsewhere on Facebook with my name, David Ludwig, MD.
And since you're a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, you can certainly leverage that influence to have an impact on our kids who are increasingly obese. And, you know, once you sort of create the template for obesity in childhood, it becomes a lifelong problem. So that's a great place to start.
This book is, you know, the book is written for, you know, adults, but, you know, there's no better way of supporting children than for them to see their parents as role models and creating almost a sacred protected zone of health within the home, a sanctuary against the toxic environment. That's the best protection for kids. And of course, you know, we do have to address this generation of children who are heavier from earlier in life than any generation ever has been before.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for your pioneering work. I wish you much success with the book, and I urge your listeners to check it out. It's Always Hungry by Dr. David Ludwig. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.